Hi, welcome back to Mixed Identity. This is your host, Heather Puri, and you might be wondering, gosh, where'd you go? We didn't have any episodes in January, and this is my Valentine's present to you. Is Mixed Identity back? I just want to let you know that there are other parts of my identity that affect my work that I do on my podcast, and the two biggest things is being a mother. And so we had pink eye and colds and snow days and kids were out for the holidays and Martin Luther King Day and all these days that I would normally have a little extra time because my kids are in preschool for a little while to work on my podcast. I haven't been able to. There was also a guest who had a scorpion bite. But it was on my side too, because we had a snow day, but she was like, oh God, I didn't sleep at all. I had a scorpion bite. So she'll be coming soon. We rescheduled to talk later, but there's just been a lot of life getting in the way. And that is what has happened. My first priority is my kids. It's my first job is being a mom right now, which is, lovely and a struggle at the same time. So with that, I'm going to talk about something that affected my thoughts on mixed race, right? Or mixed ethnicity. So my son is getting ready to go to kindergarten and I needed to register him for kindergarten. And I had to fill out all this paperwork and I got to answering a question for his race. And when I got there, it looked like you could only choose one. They had a drop-down menu and it was Asian and white and Native American and Pacific Islander and all the standard ones that you see. And so I sat there with my son who has a father who is East Indian or South Asian. He has me who is Tsimshian and white, and all of those are part of his identity and I have to choose for him. Like you know, if you want to go back to his episode, and he thinks of himself as a Punjabi Tsimshian, and how do I choose for him? So I actually had to stop that paperwork for like an hour before I could decide which one I would pick. And I ended up picking Asian. And the great thing is, after I picked that, I was able to then pick more, and I was actually able to specify Asian, which was great, because, you know, Chinese people are really, like, very different from Indian people, who are different from Filipino people, who are different from even within, you know, there's different types of Chinese and different types of Indians. So if you are Gujarati, you are very different from a Punjabi, right? And all the other groups in there as well. So I was actually able to pick Asian, and then I was able to pick Punjabi, and then I was able to pick more. But I had to stop what I was doing. I mean, this process took me like 8 hours already to like collect all the documents I needed to submit and all these kind of things. And I had to stop for an hour. I went and cleaned my kitchen and I was just like, oh my gosh, like what am I gonna choose for my son? Like, how do I choose what his identity is? And I don't know if my parents ever had that thought. I don't know. I know when I choose for myself in boxes, I like to choose multiple, but if I'm not allowed, I will always pick the Alaska Native box because I want us to be counted. And we're often underrepresented in the census and in all types of things. So this kindergarten like journey, finding the right kindergarten and beyond kindergarten, like he will spend, most schools here go to fifth grade. He'll spend 6 years of his life at this place. And I am just really struggling because we live in a really white area. And so we went and toured and I talked to a principal. And this is mostly me needing to get this out because I am just blown away at the privilege that are at these elementary schools. Like, I thought I went to a really good elementary school in, you know, outside of LA. Like, I remember as being a blue ribbon school, and I remember thinking, gosh, we have so much to be offered here. But these schools, and And it just has to do with the property taxes. And beyond that, like, this principal would say it over and over again, like, you guys are paying for this. Like, they have reading specialists, they have a full-time performing arts teacher, a full-time visual arts teacher, I mean, who goes throughout the whole school, a full-time technology teacher, a full-time librarian, like, all of the reading specialists, all of these quote-unquote extras, which are so important to the building growing of children, right? Like, you want them to have these in addition to math and science and language, which they get in their classroom. And then you look at the technology lab. One of the schools we looked at had this, you know, like 20 fancy Macintoshes. And another school, each kid got their own dedicated iPad, not an iPad that you share. Like, each kid got their own iPad. And I can't, like, the privilege, it actually disgusts me. Like, I'm so excited, and I know my kids are going to thrive here, but I know what the kids down in South Seattle are getting, right? Like, they aren't getting the same. They aren't getting the same. They don't have dedicated iPads. They don't have full-time performing arts. And maybe they do. Maybe Seattle is amazing and provides that for every school. But where I went to, that wasn't the case, right? Like, and in high school, I went to 3 different high schools. And I got to see which each one of them have. And I just know, like, the school that I was supposed to go to, that we lived in and grew up in, not that I tested into to get out of this school or those type of things. Like, we had band. There was no performing arts at all. No performing arts. Like, the extras weren't there. The number of honors and AP classes that were offered were minuscule in comparison to the other high schools that I went to that had, you know, so many classes to offer. You know, not just AP English, but you took AP literature and AP blah, blah, blah. And all these things, and it just, this is not so much, I just need to get this out. This is not so much about having a mixed identity. I guess part of it is because I come from being poor. And part of my identity is growing up in a much lower socioeconomic status. Like, that's where I came from, you know, and I succeeded, and we've come up. And we live at a completely different socioeconomic status. We live in the best school district the best school area in Seattle. And, oh my God, they just get so much. And this is, it's so not fair in the privilege that just exists. So that's what I said to this principal. I was like, this school is amazing. And I said the word, it has so much privilege. And you could see her visibly tense. I also asked her about anti-bias training for teachers. And they're just getting to it this year. It's their focus for this year, you know. So that's awesome. And just the number of fundraisers that they have and the number of those things. And so I actually think this school, there's 2 schools we're looking at. I think that my son will really thrive in this one, and I wonder if I will thrive because of my mixed identity of being someone who grew up in a lower socioeconomic household and going to schools that had less and not knowing. And that's a crazy thing. This principal, you could just see it. And I've had conversations about this before with people who are not they're not the 1% or even like the top 10% or something, right? They don't see themselves as privileged because they don't understand that there are people who have so much less than they do. And they only see people with so much more. So I was having a conversation with a mom once, and I talk all the time about what a privilege I have. I have to stay home with my kids. This is a privilege. I have a partner who can support me not working. And most families cannot do that, right? And they, and you even think of like single parents who are on the lower economic status. Like, they have to put their children in childcare that might not be is not as awesome and privileged as the childcare I pay thousands of dollars for a month for my kids, you know, who aren't even going there full time. Like, I have so much privilege, and I'm able to share that with my kids, and my kids are growing up with so much privilege, and I'm around people who don't see themselves as privileged because, like this mom I was talking to, she's stay at home too. I'm so privileged to be able to stay at home. And she just looked at me like, no, we're not privileged. The people who are privileged are the ones who can go to work and pay someone else to raise their kids. And I just think, gosh, that is super, like, yes, that's a privilege, like, to kind of be not have to do all the minutia if you can afford to, you know. I know there are like dual Amazon working families who have like a morning nanny and then their kids go to daycare and they have an evening nanny and they have to have that help because they have to work. Our culture is built so they have to work like they don't have kids. And there is a privilege in that, but there is also a privilege in being able to stay home because there are families who don't have that choice. Like they have to go work at their McDonald's jobs and their Walmart's jobs and whatever the job happens to be, like they need to be there and they don't always get to put their kids in really safe, wonderful places. And so this real, and in our society, I don't think people move like my brother and I and my dad have as much, right? Like, I see my family, those of us who have chosen paths to escalate us into different socioeconomic places. Like, my dad, will regularly say, like, he's the epitome of the American dream, right? Like, he's a kid who grew up with one pair of pants. I know he has a big house and he was able to like support a family of six kids and they get to travel and do lots of great fun things, and definitely living at a different socioeconomic status. This can happen when I was like 16 or 17 years old. And they were able to move up. And my brother and I also exist at this higher socioeconomic status. And it just amazes me that people cannot see their privilege. Like, they can't see it. Like, they don't. How can we help people see their privilege? Because I think what it is that oftentimes they will see others who have more and they say, those are the people that are privileged. I don't have privilege. Do you know who has a crap ton of privilege? I do. Heather Puri. I have so much privilege. I'm white, received in the world. I live at a higher socioeconomic status now. I am an English, my first language is English. Like, I'm a United States citizen. I have so much privilege. And you know what? I recognize that. And then I try to do good things with it. Like, have these conversations with people. Like, bring it in. Because I can say things in situations where other people can't, right? Like, I can, it's still scary. It's still scary because you don't want to make someone mad by calling them out on something that they do. But you, when you have privilege, privilege is not a bad thing. Privilege is an awesome thing. Privilege is so cool. Like, I wish everyone had the privilege, you know, like everyone could have performing arts teachers and iPads for all the kids and all those great things. Like, I wish that we could all have that. Every kid would receive the same education. And I super wish that we could do that. And that we paid our teachers better. And that we valued the education of our young people more than we do in this country. And then we wouldn't need affirmative action. If everyone was on a level playing field, like, that would be brilliant. But we're not. And some of us get to start the race earlier. You know, or if you think about it, like building a fence, some of us have a power drill and all the pieces already cut and we can go and build that fence. Other people are just starting with the logs and they might have to fashion their own tools and they don't have the resources and the privilege that we have. So when you have privilege, you got to think of ways to use it. And I'm not the perfect person to talk about how to use that privilege. I think there's a lot of great people who address this. And I think Andre Hendry, I talk about in a previous podcast, and there's just a lot of social activists who are out there, anti-racism. And I think that's the focus, is like when you look at anti-racism, it's acknowledging your privilege and then actively using that privilege to stop racism. even racism for yourself. And I have racism. Like I'm a product of this culture. So there are things I have to find myself doing and stepping back from and acknowledging, and I mess up too, right? And just being able to be like, to thank you, thanking someone if they call you out that you mess up, you know, instead of feeling ashamed about it, you know. You can feel ashamed, but not getting angry, you know. I know my first response to everything is anger. And so really taking that back and saying, I don't mean to do that. So anyways, that's just me talking a bit about mixed identity and all the different things that make us up and how that affects it. And so we're going to have an ad break soon. You're going to hear some awesome ads, probably the ones you've already heard before. But, you know, every time you listen to it, I get like a penny. So it's really exciting. I have an amazing guest for you today. This is someone I've known for a long time. We haven't been, we've been colleagues at different places and lived in the same state every once in a while. And we reconnect and go back and forth. But she is amazing. Her name is Marisol, and she's just super talented and amazing, and her story and how she's come, how she's balanced her two identities and how she has continuing to learn and grow in both of in those ways, and how being, oh, she's just fantastic. And you will hear more about her. And she, I'm just lucky to have crossed paths with her so many times. She challenges me as a person, and an artist, and just how, she helps remind me why I love art, even when we are, when that art is created in a very white space. And she is someone who, she's just awesome. So you will get to hear from Marisol, and I hope you enjoy it. And we are going to keep going. So here's to great 2020. You are a super busy woman right now. I see so many different things coming across my Instagram and my Facebook with all that you're doing, which is really neat. And you were teaching this morning?
Yeah, so I co-teach with my friend Janet a residency at a school in Crown Heights. This is for the New Victory Theater. It's called Spark Schools with Performing Arts Reach Kids. And I think it's like the fourth or fifth year of the Spark program at this school. And the idea is that these Spark residencies happen in elementary school and middle schools all over the city that don't have full-time arts teachers. Nice. So the kids come to 2 to 3 shows a season at the theater, and then we do a series of 15 workshops over the course of the school year that reflect and incorporate some of what they're seeing on stage and prepare them to see the shows. And then at the end of the year, we make something together, and there's a wide range of what that ends up looking like. But you know, it's something that reflects what we've been doing all year.
Oh, that sounds like a great program, and a great way to engage your talents. So
yeah,
I'm going to introduce you. Hi, welcome to Mixed Identity, the podcast where I, your host, Heather Puri, interview amazing people who happen to come from mixed race or mixed ethnicity backgrounds. And I do that because I love their story. And today I have a super amazing special guest. And I want her to say her name because she says it better with her amazing accent, I guess, is the way I like to say it. But I have amazing guests who I have known for a very long time, but we have only been in the same places maybe a year or two out of our lives. But so my guest is Marisol.
Hi.
Lisa Shapiro. And can you say your name for everyone? Because I'd say it in the very Anglican way.
Yes, I will say for you my entire name, which is, yes, Marisol Kimberly Rosa Shapiro. And there's my last name, Rosa Shapiro, is hyphenated. I often get asked if it's because I'm married, and it's not because I'm married. It's because of my mixed identity.
Yes. And You're one of, are you, if you ever got married, did you ever think, will I then hyphenate my name again?
I don't think so. I think if I got married, I would just keep my name.
Yeah. I think that is a good thing. But you think, cause our generation is like the first hyphenated kid generation.
Uh-huh.
And so I wonder if there are any families who did like the double hyphenated. So like four hyphenated names. Probably
not. I do know, a family like that in LA. They're Jewish and their kids have like they now have two girls, I think. And both the girls have like five names, including two. No, I think they have six names each because they each have like two hyphenated last names, one hyphenated last name from each parent. So they actually have like a four name last name.
That is so, I want to talk to those kids like in like 10 years and see how that was, because I'm finding as I interview people on this that names mean a lot, like having your name. It's something I didn't experience because, you know, I grew up Heather Beale. Mm-hmm. Which is like it's a very white name. But having your identity in your name and having each part of it is like one way that you can do that. So we'll start with my very first question, which is typically, how do you identify Marisol?
Yeah. So I identify, I would say, first and foremost, probably as a New Yorker. I was born and raised in New York City, so that's like my, and I find wherever I go in the world, that seems to be like my most the lens through which I see the world a lot is really being a New Yorker. So
So
I'm a New Yorker, I'm a woman, I am Puerto Rican and Jewish, and I, the thing about being a New Yorker too, that's kind of cool, and then being Puerto Rican and Jewish, is that I grew up in a place where, even like regardless of what was happening in my actual sort of family and home space, the culture of the city that I grew up in is so informed by and so full of both Puerto Ricans and Jews, like
mm-hmm,
everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was always being exposed to those cultures, even like outside of my own family, and sometimes like more deeply actually in my experiences outside of my own family experience, or I don't even know about deeper, but in a more multifaceted way, you know.
Could you give an example of something like that? Like it doesn't have to juxtapose like what you would experience in your house, but then also, or your home, and what you would experience, like, or just an example of something. I know exactly what you're talking because I've lived like outside of New York for a while, and just those two cultures permeate New York. Like that, like you can't, you know, it just permeates. You can't get away from it there. But for those listeners who maybe have never been or have just been to, you know, see a great Broadway show, which is great anyways, but can you talk about an experience you might have had either as an adult or a child that kind of helps you, helps explain that a little better?
Yeah, absolutely. So on the Jewish side, for example, I grew up identifying as culturally Jewish, I mean, and culturally Puerto Rican, but as far mm-hmm. as the Jewish side is concerned specifically, I definitely grew up like recognizing and identifying with my culturally Jewish heritage, but was not religiously Jewish. I was mm-hmm. actually baptized mm-hmm. Roman Catholic, and then I didn't go through any of the rites of Judaism. I actually didn't go through any of the other rites of Catholicism either, besides being baptized.
Yeah.
But I was surrounded by people who were experiencing their Jewish identity in a whole range of ways, including, you know, like me, like super, you know, culturally Jewish, but like super, super, super secular. And then also I had friends who were Jewish who identified as more religious or even like pretty secular, but then they experienced some rites that I was, you know, involved in some way, but didn't get to do for myself. So for example, a lot of my Jewish friends when I was in middle school were being bar and bat mitzvahed, which is,
yep.
you know, the rite that people go through to become an adult in the Jewish faith. I think it's girls are 12 and boys are 13 or something like that. And so I was never bat mitzvahed, but tons of my friends were. And even though a lot of the religious content sort of went over my head, like I don't speak Hebrew and I didn't necessarily catch all of it, I still recognize, I still felt some part of myself and some part of my identity being mirrored back to me through my friends' experiences in a more religious way, which is very, 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 very cool.
Yeah. Can I, did you ever ask your parents to be, is it a bar is for male gender and then female is bav with a V? I think.
Did you ever ask, with a T.
Okay. Did you ever ask your parents why? Like for me, I grew up in LA, outside of LA, and all my friends were going through quinceañeras, and I was just like, why can't I have a quinceañera? And you know, discovered again in my life multiple times that I wasn't Mexican. And so did you ever? But I was like, why? All my friends are doing this. Why am I not? Did you ever ask your parents?
No, I think I've always felt pretty sure that a religious rite was not the kind of rite of passage that I identified with.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I suppose I went to some bar and bat mitzvahs that felt a little bit more secular, but really it is a religious rite. So like everyone who has a bar and bat mitzvah, in my experience, you know, had gone to Hebrew school, learned to read a portion of the Torah, like it really is a religious rite. So I was not exposed to quinceañeras. I never was interested in the Catholic rites of passage. Mm-hmm. So I think
I wanted to go to CCD when I was a kid because like all my friends were Catholic. All of them were Catholic and for the most part, either Filipino or Mexican. And I was just like, why are we not Catholic? I want to be Catholic too. They do cool things. My parents were like, no, we're Mormon. And I was like, sorry. All right, fine.
Well, did you have any Mormon rites of passage like that? Like rituals?
When you get baptized at 8 years old and, which I think is, and it's like, because that's the age as a child that you can make your own decision, which I have issues with that because at eight, you just want to please your parents, which is nice, but it's not, it was never, I think being a newer religion that they just don't have the, there's something I find it and I find my attraction to Hinduism in this way because I like to say I'm Hindu by default now, but there's, there is, just those rituals and rites for religions that are just more historic are just, there's a beauty in them that I can't, it's kind of like you were saying, I think maybe I'm feeling like there's just something in the historical, like this has been going on for so long. There's just a beauty to it that like goes beyond words that I don't think, and maybe Mormonism doesn't, it happens in the temple, but I left the church before I got to go there. So, but we will move on from, is there anything else like for your Puerto Rican side that you, you said, and so knowing you, I knew you were Jewish when I first met you, but I did not know you were mixed race and I did not know you were Puerto Rican when we did our internship together.
Hmm.
Yeah, I know. I mean, we weren't like the closest people.
We were just kind of in the same orbit, but we didn't spend a ton of time together.
No. Like so every once in a while, like after a show or something, but yeah. but I thought you were just Jewish. But that means nothing. But I was wondering, like I have a friend who is Puerto Rican, but her dad was, I don't think this is your case, but her dad, it was, I like to call them white supremacists, even if they're people of color, but they adopt this idea that white is the best.
Mm-hmm.
And really denied his Puerto Rican identity, actually would tell everybody that he was an Ashkenazi Jew. I think I said that right.
Ashkenazi?
Yes, thank you.
Uh-huh.
I think I was combining like a tribe up in Alaska with that. Okay. But anyway. But she has recently come to identify more as Puerto Rican than Japanese, and which is she identified as white and Japanese much more when she was growing up and has embraced her Puerto Rican identity later in life and is actually taking time to learn Spanish and those kind of things. But do you feel as a child you were given both and that or at growing up, or does one identity ever overshadow? Have you been able to make a mix? I rarely identify with my white self. And if people ask me, like, I am Simpson, and then I might say I'm mixed race. But I don't. But for you, balancing those two, do you feel like do they balance? Were you able to find that balance? Did your parents help you find that balance, or your city?
I think so. I think I identify pretty strongly with both identities. It's interesting that you say this thing about like whiteness in Puerto Rican identity, because so my grandmother, so just to give you a little context on my Puerto Rican side, my grandparents on my mom's side, my mom's parents, were both born on the island. My grandmother, Julia, was born in Juncos, and my grandfather, Jose, who we called Puche, was born in a town called San Sebastian up in the mountains. And they both ended up moving to New York pretty young, like as teenagers. And they very much lived an immigrant experience, even though they were not technically immigrants, because Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. But they lived an immigrant experience in the sense that they came. They were poor. They spoke another language. They were discriminated against. They were working class. They worked in factories, right? And all this, and all the other, all kinds of other sort of traumatic content, right, of being an immigrant, basically, and being regarded as an immigrant. So one of the things that's kind of interesting about my family is that my grandfather, Puche, or Jose, who was from up in the mountains in San Sebastian, was racially white. I mean, his phenotype, like his skin was, you know, white. And although he also looks kind of East Asian, it's very interesting in a totally, you know, not politically correct way. His friends, when he was young, nicknamed him Chino.
Yeah.
Because they thought he looked Chinese or, you know, East Asian. So, but, and who knows, because the thing about Puerto Rico, right, and all these islands is that all kinds of people came through and spread their seed and mixed. Puerto Rican culture and identity is fundamentally, you know, fundamentally a mix of Taino, who are the indigenous people of Puerto Rico, the Tainos, the African presence. Africans ended up in Puerto Rico because of slavery. And Spanish or European, right? Those are the three primary identities. But there are all kinds of people from all over the world who went through Puerto Rico and left there. So who knows? There might be some East Asian blood somewhere. But anyway, so my grandfather was, you know, basically white in terms of his phenotype and his presentation. But he was he looked maybe Chino. And then my grandmother, as far as I know, her father was black, Puerto Rican, and her mother, I think, was of European and maybe some Taino descent as well. So, but my grandmother had definitely some internalized anti-black stuff going on. You know, this colorism and racism issue is present all over the world. And especially among Caribeños, right, there's a definite, like, strong anti-Black sentiment. So I say all of this to get back to your question, I think, about, you know, parts of my identity that I've that I got from the outside. I feel like that's the question that you asked me. Now I lost it a little bit.
It's okay, but it's really interesting what you're saying, so we're just going to go with it.
Great. So one of the things that I'm now engaged in, my grandfather passed away in 2003, and my grandmother, and they were living in Puerto Rico at the time. So they were born in Puerto Rico. They came to New York in Brooklyn. They lived in Brooklyn until I was born. So for oh my gosh, like 40 some years or something. Then they moved back to the island right when I was born, which is kind of a bummer because they weren't around as much, but it was beautiful because I got to visit them, right, in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. as a kid, I would go visit them in Puerto Rico. My grandfather died in 2003, and then my grandmother moved back to New York, and she passed away in May of 2019. So ever since her passing, I have been, I mean, I think it started probably with Hurricane Maria when I was like, oh my God, you know, there's all this destruction happening on the island. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I haven't been there in, you know, 16 or 17 years. And I, you know, I feel disconnected and I really want to be helpful, to be present, to, you know, uplift my people and do yeah. what I can in the diaspora, right? In the Puerto Rican diaspora to like support the island. But, you know, so it started with Maria and then my grandmother passed away. And she was the last, really close connection to the island. So, you know, my mom mm-hmm. was born and raised in Brooklyn. I have a bunch of cousins on the island, but they're people I've never met and I don't know.
Yeah.
And I have family friends, very, very, very close family friends who basically are family also on the island still. But when my grandmother passed, I was like, okay, I feel like an urgency and a hunger to really reconnect with my culture. And besides the fact that my grandmother passed away, it's also like between Maria and the economic crisis and mm-hmm. now these earthquakes and this corrupt yeah. government and the United States government treating Puerto Rico like trash and all yes. these Puerto Ricans leaving the island because of all these disasters. It's like I have this urgent feeling that the culture is threatened, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So as I'm connecting to, as I'm doing my own work, right, to connect to my Puerto Rican heritage, one thing that's becoming very clear is that my mother, and therefore I, have been, to some extent, intentionally, like, disconnected from the African part of the roots mm-hmm, of our culture. Mm-hmm. Because of my grandmother, right? Because yeah. of both the grandparents, but because of this like anti-Black sentiment among Puerto Ricans and yeah. the feeling that even my grandmother as a like, you know, brown woman with African heritage, like not so far back, right? Her father was Black, felt this need to sort of dismiss the Black part of the culture, which is of mm-hmm. course an impossible thing to do because it's deeply embedded in everything about the culture. Even white Puerto yeah. Ricans, you know, our food, our music, our language, our everything mm-hmm. is just, it has the African, you know, content. But in terms of some of the like rites, rituals, you know, community building sort of rituals that happen that come from African culture, that is stuff that my mother was never really connected to in an mm-hmm, overt way, mm-hmm. and I wasn't either. But it's a big part of how I'm now reconnecting, is like Bombay Plena and some of this, some of the like African diaspora part of being Puerto Rican. I don't even remember, again, what your question was.
It's okay, but I want to continue on this way
yeah.
because I want to know how, so in a lot of ways, it's assimilation, and I find yes. that, and continues to be, and it's so funny when I say this around like full white people, but like assimilation is safety. And so I cannot, like there, I've gone through a journey of being very angry at like forced assimilation or seeing people, because it was forced, right? On like the children were ripped from the Simpson families, my grandmother was put in boarding schools, like mouth washed out with lye if she spoke her language. So forced assimilation. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, I would get angry at these people who chose it. And what I realized is it wasn't really a choice.
That's
because
true.
They wanted to be safe. And you can change the food you eat. You can change your religion. You can change those things, because being brown in our country is not safe. And so changing everything else about you to be less brown is a choice of safety, and even economic safety. So it might not be like knife at your throat safety, but it is still safety. So economic safety and that kind of stuff. But with that, forced assimilation or choosing safety assimilation is, I'll find a better term for it. But how are you reconnecting with, what I find is, in the Simpson culture, especially the part that's in the U.S., was less able to retain. And finding this for all Native tribes, I've been studying a lot, but when they go back to rediscover, there's it's difficult, right? Like they can study things in museums and they can look at pictures, but a lot of the history is being lost because, like, I don't think my grandmother, until she was older, ever participated in a potlatch because they were deemed, you know, satanic. And so finding the actual history is harder, and it's almost, but my question is, how are you going about reconnecting with that? Because I find it interesting, especially some women I've met here who don't know their mothers did and their grandmothers did similar things, like distance themselves from the Native part. And but how are you connecting to that? Because I find that really interesting and I want to hear more about that story.
Sure. So I mean, I'm definitely at the sort of beginning of that journey, I would say. But this is really beautiful timing for us to be talking about this because, you know, I just went back to right before Christmas time, mm-hmm. I went back to Puerto Rico for the first time, since my grandfather passed away, which is really hard to believe, but it was really amazing. I mean, it was a brief visit. You know, I saw some family, friends. I had some vacation time on the beach, much needed. But you know, I also was starting to like reorient myself. One beautiful thing that happened is a really, really close family friend who's basically a cousin. You know, she was the first person that we saw that we knew when we got to the island. I was there with my partner and, you know, she gives me a hug when she sees me and says like, welcome home, you know, so beautiful. Mm-hmm. But since getting back, so when we were there, we went to a bombazo, and a bombazo is, basically an event where there is percussion and dancing and it can be more formalized, like everybody is playing percussion in a big circle and then one at a time the dancer comes into the middle, bows to the sort of lead percussionist, and the drummer and the dancer have this this complicit sort of experience of the drum and the dance happening at the same time, but it's completely improvised, right?
That's so beautiful.
It was so beautiful. Oh, and there's also singing. Like there's a singer who actually, the singer actually leads the entire event and sings the coro, right? And everybody else who's part of the bombazo, it's like a call and response, right? So the singer sings a line, and then the people in the bombazo sing a line, and it goes back and forth. And it was the first time I'd ever been to a bombazo. And it was so interesting because I felt very close to it. I felt in my blood and my bones that this is something that is part of like my makeup somewhere.
Yes.
But because I'd never been there, the degree to which I could read and understand the event in a sort of like intellectual way was very limited, right?
Yeah.
So I was observing the ritual. I was like observing what was happening. I was understanding the pattern and like the relationships that were happening. And it was one of the most amazing things I've ever experienced. And it was beautiful because the whole room, you know, it really reflected the sort of range of Puerto Rican identities, which is to say everything from white, blonde, and blue eyed to like black, you know, clearly of like almost all African heritage, like everybody in the room, every body type, every, you know, height. I mean, there was a male identified person dancing in the middle of the circle in a skirt, which was some kind of an homage to like his mother. It was incredibly beautiful. Anyway, so this is very much an African, you know, this is very much from the African diaspora. And there are similar kinds of dances in other parts of the African diaspora in the Caribbean, like in Cuba. But this is a very specifically very Puerto Rican. The bombazo is a very Puerto Rican ritual from the African diaspora. So anyway, I went to that bombazo. I was like, this is amazing. I can only sort of read it, but I love it. And it feels like I belong here, you know? And then I came back to New York over the course of January, there was this, like, Indigenous Voices programming at La Mama experimental theater company on 4th Street near where my mom lives in New York. And the only show I was unfortunately able to get to was actually a Puerto Rican show that addressed some Taíno identity. And it ended in a really informal bombazo. So at the end of the show, as a kind of surprise, there was a drummer in the show anyway, but then as a kind of surprise, a guy who happened to be a very beautiful Puerto Rican guy who was sitting behind me during the show, like, came out with a drum also. And then he was playing and the other drummer was playing and people were invited to, like, come up and dance, you know, just like the bombazo I'd been at. And we were already sitting in a circle because that was the seating for the show anyway. So then people would come in and dance. And then, so the bombazo now, which is something I'd never been exposed to, right, before, like, mm-hmm. December, keeps coming into my life. And then I found out that this group called Los Pleneros de la 21, who are a Puerto Rican music and dance sort of collective based in El Barrio in Spanish Harlem, do these weekly classes in both the dance of bomba y plena and in the music making.
Oh, that's so exciting to find.
Yeah. So I went to my first dance class last night and it was like, I don't know. It was amazing. It felt like a homecoming. I'm obsessed. I'm going to go every week. And I feel in my mind and my heart and my gut, like, so much hunger and connection, and sort of like there's like a relief because it's like the universe is somehow offering me the opportunity to connect with this thing, like, just when I need it.
Yes.
And it's something I haven't been aware of having access to before in my life. So
That's great. And I think we did get back to, like, what is playing a role, like, in your life. And I feel that too, like, moving to Seattle at the time that we did and my choices with work and being able to embrace my Simpson, like, this, Seattle's like one of the few cities in the lower 48 where I can be with a contingent of Simpsons, right? And so and then Native people too, we have just the Indian Daybreak Star here, and there is a community here that, like, when I was living on the East Coast or when I was living in other places, like, it just didn't exist for me, and I needed it, and I needed it in my life right now. And this is so I love hearing that because it does feel I know every time I hear hoo-ha, right? Like, it's like when we dance, when I hear the drums in that way, it's something that's, like, inside my body, like, and it just is magical. And it was so infrequent in my life until just recently. So I love hearing that. And I do have one more question because I love your perspective on this, but I'd like to talk about how the world identifies you and how you kind of navigate that. We're both women with very strong identities that don't reflect what the world sees.
That's right. So it's interesting. When I was younger, a lot of people used to tell me that I looked, quote, exotic. And I'm not exactly sure what that meant. I mean, I think that I'm quite Jewish looking. I have this hair that is, the texture of my hair is definitely a mix of my Puerto Rican and my Jewish sides. Because my dad, who's Jewish, has curly hair, but it's like these very big loose curls. And then my mom, who's Puerto Rican and has this African blood, this African heritage, has, like, really, 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 really tight, almost like, almost like kinky curls. Like, she used to have an afro when she was, you know, in college. And my hair is somewhere in between. So when people kind of, like, try to figure me out, they're like, well, you look like, I don't know, maybe Jewish, maybe Italian, maybe Jewish, I don't know, but then you have curly hair, like, but I think I'm very blessed, speaking as you did earlier to names, that my name is Marisol, because it automatically makes people understand that I'm not just white, even though I think I'm white received.
Yes.
And And, it, you know, there's also some more complexity to be sort of excavated around whiteness and Latino identity, and especially Caribbean identity, where you can be, you can, you know, your phenotype can be white, like racially, but your ethnic heritage is very mixed and informed, as I was saying before, by like Taino, indigenous, and African influences, right? So, but anyway, so I think I am received as white, but also as Latina when people hear my name. And it's very interesting. I mean, I've heard other people talk about this on your podcast before. But being in this place where I am, you know, sometimes it feels like parts of my identity, because they're not obvious, are erased in certain settings. But then I also have this ability to show up in different spaces, you know, confident in my complex identity and with the lens of complexity, right? And understanding that we can't make assumptions about people's identities, and also that, you know, race and phenotype and the way that you look in the world, regardless of how you identify, the way that you look in the world has real world consequences. Like, I am very aware that whether or not I identify as white, I completely 100,000% benefit from white privilege, right? And I think that even just that understanding is something that, unfortunately, the majority of people don't understand, right? And so I think, especially because I'm an educator and I'm always showing up in spaces where people look different from me, I'm able to, you know, I just have an awareness and I'm able to gauge, hopefully with a decent amount of sensitivity and success. I think I am, but who knows? I'm also prone to, you know, screwing up like everybody. But I think I'm able to enter space and understand how I'm received, and then and still hold on in the inside to my understanding of my complexity, but gauge when it is and isn't the appropriate moment or space or time to, like, you know, to go there, like to talk about it. And sometimes it's just not. Like, if I'm in an all black space, I'm like, I'm usually, I assume, at least at first, right, received as white, and that's fine because comparatively, right, I am white in an all black space. But I've also had black folks say to me, like, you're not white, like, you're, you know, you're Latina, like, you're something else too. Besides white. So it's fascinating. Like, I think the way I'm received really depends on where I'm at, who I'm with, whether people have heard my name yet, what I'm wearing, like how I look, right? What I'm wearing. All of that, I think being mixed, like all of that is, has an impact.
Can you talk a little bit about, you are an amazing artist. You do, all kinds of art, from clowning to teaching to, like, amazing things. But I'd just love to hear a little how you feel that, maybe you can say whether, like, it's, I think it's positive, but whether it's positive or anything that's, been challenging for you with this mixed identity and the way you present to the world. But, like, how has your identity really affected your art? Because I think you're an amazing artist, and I'd just love to hear about that.
Thank you. I think it's, you know, it's a gift and it's a challenge, right? Because, again, I come from this space where I understand some of the complexity of race and heritage and identity, right? And it's a challenge because, you know, we are always addressing, I mean, I think any artist in the 21st century who's worth their salt, who's actually trying to do anything that is relevant or new or innovative, or, you know, addressing the present moment, is like dealing with questions of identity and race and representation, right? So, it's a great question. Right now, I mean, I have really craved being in spaces that are super multiracial, multi-ethnic, multilingual, multinational, because I think I feel like creating that kind of a space as an artist and as a lead artist is like where I feel most at home, because it it both reflects where I'm from, right, as a New Yorker, and it reflects who I am in terms of my own identity. But around questions of like how my own identity might show up in my work, I think that is something that I, again, am like just starting to excavate and like scratch the surface of. I've mostly done work that feels very much sort of not about me.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I mean, it is about me in the sense that I'm a human being, and I think that I'm, you know, the work I hope addresses certain universal themes, right, that that apply to human beings and our emotional lives. But I am increasingly interested in really diving into Puerto Rican-ness, Puerto Rican stories, Puerto Rican ways of telling stories, right? And the same with Judaism. I mean, Judaism has such a beautiful, ancient relationship to storytelling and to the divine that is that infuses the storytelling. And it's like, it's so vast and it's so deep and it's so beautiful. And so one of the things that I'm interested in increasingly now as an artist is how not only, you know, is in storytelling modes that reflect my, you know, the cultural tools and materials of both parts of my heritage. So, you know, where does the bombasso fit into making a theater piece, etc. Yes.
Yeah, we're gonna have to check back in as you go along this, but I too feel the same way. Like I think something about that like nonprofit, like the theater arts space is, very very white and very I mean, I spend a lot of time on the management side, and I'm just at a place where I'm just like, I'm done. I'm done helping white people make art, and even and just creating. Like, I feel like I finally have the experience and expertise to create spaces just for me, just for Indigenous voices. Mm-hmm. Like, and I do think we're at a point, because I'm a business person, where the market exists, where we can have purely Indigenous spaces where we can invite other people in to view our voices. But I'm working on it. I'm just putting feelers out, but I want to, when my kids are in school, like my goal is to really start like just an Indigenous people's like theater week here in Seattle. And I'm like, I can find the funding, I can find the audience, like the market's right for it. And that's my MBA talking. But it's like finding those artists to put those voices to it and having them not be, because I find in a lot of the spaces that you and Hayaf had existed in together, in these like very professionalized theater spaces, like even when there is there are people of color artists, it's still put in a form to be digested by white audience. Does that make sense?
Big time. Of course.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it's Aristotelian, you know, structure of storytelling. It's European, you know, plays. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that is just that. I think we're at a place where I do even think that, like, you have an environment. I just think we can. It's time. It's time. I think there's enough of us. Like, I spent a decade learning the business side. So let me take that and like make art not for white people.
Yeah.
But white people can come and enjoy the art, and I think they'd love it, but not to be like, well, that's our audience. That's who, you know, that's what our subscribers want kind of thing. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Mentality. But, so we're going to have to check back in where you go with this, because I just cannot. I will produce your work someday.
Yay.
Yeah. But I would love, at the end of these, thank you so much for your time. At the end of these, I always share something that's really making me think or I'm really into, and I'd love you to share something too. So I just finished listening to the most amazing book. It has changed me spiritually, which is to say a lot, because I have not been a spiritual person maybe ever in my life.
Hmm.
It's called Braiding Sweetgrass, and it's indigenous. Yes, it's indigenous wisdom, scientific knowledge, and the teaching of plants. My problem with spirituality has always been that my scientific analytic mind could not wrap itself around it. And this book, and the way it thinks about our interactions with our fellow beings on this planet. So I mean, animals and plants in the water and all those things. It has spoken to me in such a way that I am like, oh my God, like I could be a spiritual person. I don't know. But but it's really been life changing. And it's by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And she just, it is just a beautiful book. And if you do the audio, she reads it, and it's just, I like want to go listen to it again. And so that's my thing. That's just, it's amazing. It's just taking that and how you can be a scientific analytic mind and also understand the beauty and spiritualness of our world. And that it just really spoke to me. So is there anything that you are really, into right now?
Yeah, so I want to second, actually, Braiding Sweetgrass, which I haven't finished yet, partly because it's so delicious to read that I'm really taking my time with it. And I just absolutely love it. And I think, have you read Emergent Strategy by Adrienne Marie Brown?
No.
So I feel like Emergent Strategy and Braiding Sweetgrass are great books to read kind of in conversation with each other. Like, I would recommend Emergent Strategy next.
All right. Thank you. I need a book.
Yeah, because it's also about, especially having just read Braiding Sweetgrass, because it's about sort of like making change and activism and grassroots, transformation largely through the lens of sort of biomimicry and natural systems. So Braiding Sweetgrass, yes. And I always love, so I listen to the Code Switch podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Do you listen to Code Switch?
It hasn't been a regular listen lately, but I have. They have this amazing one on historical like trauma, and it's an Alaska Native family, and it just was life changing. But yeah, I do off and on.
Yeah, I love Code Switch. I find less so maybe in recent like this. I don't know, less so maybe in the last like 10 episodes or so, but. For a while, I felt like every single episode of Code Switch, I was like, oh my God, I've been thinking about that thing or I felt that thing before and I've never heard anybody talk about it. It's kind of like actually how I feel about your podcast.
Thanks.
And it's just, it's felt very exciting and very connected to me. And I've only met one other Marisol in my life. And weirdly enough, it was in Seattle, which is crazy. But the host, one of the hosts of Code Switch, of course, is Shireen Marisol Meraji, which I love. She's Iranian and Puerto Rican.
Awesome.
So even just hearing her talk about her relationship to those two parts of her life is really cool for me. But yeah, I would second Braiding Sweetgrass. I think everyone should read it. It's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited. They're going to, they do this like young children educating series for Native families. And like they have, they're actually going to teach you how to breed sweetgrass. So I'm just like, we have to go. So hopefully my kids might nap and do all that great stuff. So we can go. Well, thank you again so much for your time. And we're definitely going to have to check back in when you are just this journey you're going on. It just sounds so exciting. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Hey, listeners, if you've made it this far, I want to ask you a favor. If you could go over to Apple Podcasts and put a review and what you think of Mixed Identity, that would be super helpful. Again, if you have any thoughts of the episode that you just heard, you can check us out at Facebook at Identity Mixed or Instagram at Identity_Mixed. And I'd love to continue this conversation.
Our theme music is Ice Flow by Kevin McLeod, licensed by Creative Commons. It can be found at filmmusic.io or incomtech.com.